Hello, everybody, all of our listeners in America and all around the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host, my friend Perkins. Joining me as always is Chris Deloge. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
This is for March 2nd, 2024, first show of the month. We are slowly getting ourselves out of winter and going into spring, even though it doesn't really feel like it, because it has been cold and rainy the last couple of days, because, you know, that's Georgia for you. But anyway, so what have we got for this week? Well, among other things, ExxonMobil is proving once again why they're one of the most disliked corporations on the planet. And that ire apparently even goes to their own investors. Some awful shit went down in Palestine. My home state is doing stupid shit, which is unfortunately not uncommon. We got a celebrity death to discuss. The GOP is dealing with some turmoil involving some people resigning. We also have some news on the death of the late great Jam Master Jay. Syphilis is making a big comeback. Yeah. Fun. And of course, we got some other stuff, including some entertainment news to talk about as well. All this and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So, to start us off, as always, as is tradition, Chris, tell us, what have you been doing this week?
Well, it's been a lot of work and some weird weather, as is often the case around here. Mm-hmm. We had a pretty decent weekend, and then it got real cold, so much so that I think it was Wednesday was just a high of like 32 with a bunch of wind, 20-plus mile-an-hour winds to make it feel much colder than that. And then today, it's in the 50s. And I think tomorrow it's going to be in the 60s, and then the high of around 70 on Monday. So we are kind of in a weird place. It's been one of the mildest, warmest winters we've ever had.
Oh, yeah.
Here. And unfortunately, that means we're going to be real warm a lot faster than we're expecting, really.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't great at all. But that's kind of the weather stuff. We're going to mostly hover around in the 50s or so here for the next week, from what I can see. So that's kind of where the weather stuff is at. But for things I've been doing, not really been watching too much outside of just rewatching some things. But been playing some more Final Fantasy VII Remake. I finished up the Yuffie DLC intermission. Had a lot of fun with that. It was a nice change of pace gameplay-wise, especially when it's only two chapters, so it's not too complicated to get around.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really bounce around too much between, you know, having a story-heavy chapter where it's just a lot of talking and such.
You
know, just keep the action going, and the kind of stuff that she gets into at the end is kind of some wild stuff. That's kind of maybe some of the most anime stuff in the game.
Yeah,
especially with the final boss being just a real moody dude.
Oh, that
has some wild powers.
Mm-hmm.
To which I didn't really understand. There's a whole like genetics experimentation thing that's part of Shinra, and they don't really get into that too much.
Yeah,
but she kind of runs into the lady that's all about their heavy weapons development, and then she's like, hey, let's release this dude. And he's only one of two dudes that they show here that are sort of in this wing of, we can't even let these guys free because they're unstable.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just kill everybody. But that fight, I was trying to beat it the night before Rebirth came out, and then that was like at midnight. I was fighting that dude and ended up losing in the last phase, which was...
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't a hard fight. It was just kind of dealing with keeping up on health for the most part is what that dude's all about. Because he'll whittle away at it and kind of catch you sleeping if you're not paying attention. But the neat thing is once you, I ended up beating it the next day, first time when I got home from work, so I could start Rebirth. And yeah, that was pretty good. Her whole thing takes place right before the Sector 7 plate is dropped. Mm-hmm. So she kind of ends her bits, seeing the destruction that's in front of her and kind of being unsure what to do next. And then they just kind of end the whole thing with like, well, enough of Yuffie. What's everybody else been doing? Mm-hmm. In the latest bit they would show, and they're outside of Midgar, kind of trying to figure out where to go. And yeah, it's got some fun stuff that just keeps going. And then they end with Zek being like, hey, I'm here. Shows up at Aerith's church garden place.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a bunch of, I assume, refugees from Sector 7.
Yeah.
And he's like, what's going on here? Being surprised that things have changed a little bit since he was there last. Then that kind of feeds into where Rebirth starts. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow. But that's been fun. Mm. Yeah, and let's see. I think the other main thing I've been playing is Fortnite. The season's ending here, I think, next Friday, I think the 8th. So I'm trying to work my way through it, which has not been too hard. Got all the Snake stuff done. So I have the three versions of Snake, which is Solid Snake, Old Man Snake, and then there's just a Solid Snake with like heat vision goggles on, something like that. But and all the little side stuff there is Bling, which is the little robot buddy that you put on your back. And then his little flyer thing, which is, I think it's from Metal Gear Solid 4. Like some of those flyer things that just attaches to him, the weird arm wing things. So that's kind of weird, but pretty good. Kind of working my way through a bunch of the other quests in there. So nothing really too much to say about that, but that's been pretty much all I've been doing. So Brandon, what have you been doing?
Well, as for me, my gaming has largely been centered around still Persona 3 Reload. I'm actually almost finished with it. And I'm actually about halfway through writing my review for that. Should be probably be done by tomorrow night and ready for editing. So everybody out there, be looking out for that. And yeah, this part of the game is sort of like it's the calm before the storm, more or less. You're getting all of your various characters ready to go before the big last boss that you got to fight, which I'm pretty sure in, typical Persona fashion is like two or three different boss battles, like one after the other, something like that. So you want to make sure everybody's all charged up and leveled up and all that stuff, which is good because like the actual like last area before that boss battle gives you like all of these like what they call border guardians, which are like stronger enemies that give you like a crap ton of XP after you kill them, so that you can get up to like around level 80 or whatever before you fight them. So the game is giving you all the chances to do that, but yeah, it's once again, it surprises me, as all Persona games do. But I'm glad to be playing it. Other than that, I'm also playing, still playing Splatoon 3 Side Order. I've actually gone back to like playing, online Splatoon as well, reminding myself why I both love and hate it. Love it in that Splatoon in general is one of the most fun online games you can enjoy because, you don't have to actually talk to anybody and the game is very self-explanatory from the beginning. So very easy to do, and hate it because I am terrible at it. But yeah, so that's very enjoyable. Love it. The other thing I've been doing is I've been watching a Rebuild of Evangelion. For those of you who don't know, Rebuild of Evangelion is the when Evangelion itself like ended, it ended up kind of ending prematurely back in the day, which is why they ended up putting out like two movies afterwards, specifically End of Evangelion, which was meant to sort of end it, and it ends up, you know, ending on a pretty somber note, more or less. Well, years later, Hideaki Anno, the creator and showrunner of that anime, after he'd gotten, you know, remarried and, you know, gotten just tons of money and fame and all that, he decided that it was time to go back to his previous project and try to redo it closer to what he'd originally intended it for, but with, you know, a, you know, having, now that he had like the clout and like bigger budget to work on, because Evangelion famously, like, it wasn't just Evangelion, it was like all Gainax productions, famously would run out of money like very quickly during their during the show's runnings, because they would spend so much money on animating the first few episodes that by the time it came to end the actual, came to the later end, they had to like start reusing stuff and just cut back on costs and everything. Well, now he decided, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do it as a film series. And in this case, it's four different films, all of them about an hour and a half long, where he's going to go back and he's going to tell the story as he originally intended it, which is complete bullshit, because the first movie is basically an almost shot-for-shot retelling of the first season of the anime until you get to the, I think it's either the fifth or the sixth angel that you go up again. And like, even up to that point, like, it feels kind of rushed, because remember, like, they're spending like the first, I think, half to 45 minutes basically gunning like a good like six or seven episodes of what the original anime was and trying to shove all of that into it. And then the sixth angel shows up and the story goes completely sideways. And I'm almost done with the first movie. The second one, I have been told, is like almost a completely, like, all the familiar characters are there. You know, you know all of them. They're all faces you recognize, but there's also like some new characters that are put in. And some of the characters that you do know, there's something slightly off about them. And yeah, it's just, it's exciting to watch. I'm watching this all on Prime. You basically get all of them for your Prime, for your Prime subscription. And yeah, it's good. They're legitimately good movies. The first one, I will admit, does feel a little rushed, but that's because they're trying to put in like a season's worth of anime in like an hour and a half. But once that point comes in, it's like it suddenly becomes an amazing film. Other than that, just, you know, still doing some job hunting. I do have some prospects that I'm going to be going into next week, but other than that, that's pretty much it. Do you have anything that you want to add on before we move on?
No.
Alrighty then. Well, it is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And for this episode, I thought we would talk a little bit about the history of mecha, or specifically the history of people who have trying to take mecha and make it like a real life thing. Now, obviously, when you think mecha, you have like an image in your mind. You have like, you know, Gundams, maybe, you know, or maybe you have like other super, you know, giant robot stuff like, you know, Mazinger Z or Getarobo or, you know, the Megazord from Power Rangers, stuff like that. You know, Voltron, that's another one. And, you know, that image of like the giant robot is really cool. It works. You know, because just the idea of being able to like make this giant humanoid thing that you can control and actually use for warfare is admittedly a pretty neat image. And I mean, it's not exclusive to Japan either. I mean, just look at what we got, like in Star Wars. You know, we got the AT-ATs and the AT-STs and all those giant freaking things. You know, it's a pretty awesome thing. And then there was other stuff like the workloader from Aliens, or there was this really. Actually, a movie I really love, even though it's cheesy as hell, and honestly, it was a box office bomb when it came out. And honestly, it's much better made than it's given credit for. It's a movie called Robot Jocks. It came out in 1990. It's good stuff. But here's the problem. You'll notice with a lot of these shows, especially what are typically called the quote unquote real robot shows. Most of these mecha, when they are used, they're usually out in space. You know, they're fighting in space. Gundams are usually fighting out in space, stuff like that. You know, usually it's the more slightly lighthearted stuff, like, you know, Mazinger, where it's more, you know, we're not going to go hard into scientific fact here. And there is a reason for this. You see, the problem with trying to make giant humanoid machines like that is that the sheer weight of the things would cause them to buckle under. Metal is heavy, and when you're combining that with all of the various mechanisms and the wires and all the stuff that you have to put inside such a machine so that it'll actually move and work and actually like walk. Just the act of having them walk alone is a massive strain on the joints of these kinds of machines. If a lot of these machines that you see in movies or in anime or whatever, they only work purely through the power of fantasy. In real life, such a machine, if it tried to be mobile in any way, would collapse almost immediately. You know, not just because of the weight, like I said, but also just the strain that it puts on the joints of these things. That said, you know, like arguably the closest we have to anything remotely, like in anime at least, for anything remotely similar to something that could be possible is usually something that you would see in, like, you know, like a Shiro Masamune project, like, you know, like Ghost in the Shell or Appleseed or something like that, where, you know, they're not actually that large, they're only slightly larger than human size, and they're usually like piloted the way that like the front loader is in Aliens. That's pretty much the closest you can get. Anything larger than that, and the whole thing just completely just collapses under its own weight. That said, there have been numerous attempts by people to try and create an actual real-life mecha machine. Some of them have been more successful than others, so we'll talk about just a few of them, both Japanese and in the Western world as well. So one of the earliest in Japan is that actually like succeeded is from back in 2012. A company called Suadabashi Heavy Industry unveiled the prototype of what became known as the Kuritas. There are a couple of different versions of it. It was developed by Kogoro Kurita, who is a artist and mecha designer for, you know, various anime, and this was like one of his first examples of trying to engineer an actual real life project. It weighs about 4,500 kilograms. It's about 4 meters high, and it doesn't walk, because again, trying to do like a walking thing would just completely wreck it. So instead, it maneuvers about on a quartet of wheels, two in the front, two in the back. It has a 30 joint exoskeleton controlled by the pilot. It has an onboard user interface that uses a Kinect based device. It can be armed with multiple weapons, and has a humanoid hand that's called the Iron Crow that is operated by a, what at least in the prototypical version, looks sort of like the Power Glove. It also has like a pile bunker and a handgun and all this stuff. It cannot walk, nor will it probably be able to, because again, it can only move, you know, around on wheels. And it actually ended up, it was planned to actually be used in one of the Pat LaBeouf movies, but it didn't. A few years after that, a Korean company called Hanuk Mirai posted a video featuring a test run of their own bipedal mecha called Method 01, which was designed by the Russian engineer Vitaly Bulgarov. There was another land bipedal robot called the Landwalker that was developed by Sakakibara Kikai with the intention of giving the impression of bipedal mecha. And if you look at this thing, it looks a lot like it looks a lot like the machines from Mech Warrior. It also has, then of course in 2018, the Japanese engineer Masaaki Nagamo, who was also from that same company, Sakakibara Kikai, completed construction of a functional bipedal mecha inspired by the Gundam franchise. It stands about 8.5 meters tall and weighs about 7 tons and possesses fully functional arm and leg servos. Again, though, it can't really do much maneuvering because they still have to deal with the sheer stress that it does on the machinery by just working. There's also the 60 feet tall Gundam base mecha that is put on exhibit by the Gundam Factory Yokohama that was put out in 2020, and it's actually expected to remain there until the end of this month. Now, obviously, the Japanese and Koreans have done this, but they are not the only ones. We have actually had several attempts over here in the Western world to try and do something similar. For example, back in the 1800s, there was a British engineer by the name of William Brunton, who he was Scottish, not British, who developed the prototype for a steam locomotive that was propelled by mechanical legs that he called the steam horse, or the mechanical traveler, it was sometimes also called. And all it basically looks like a sort of standard prototypical locomotive with like a steam engine and all that. And then it has these two like spider legs in front of it that, you know, just sort of tick, 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 tick. That sort of pulls it forward. There's also the GE Beetle, which was a, let me look at this real quick, which was a large mobile manipulator that was built by Jared Industries in Detroit for General Electric and was ordered by the Special Weapons Center of the Air Force. And basically, its purpose was to handle nuclear material for nuclear bombers. It was about 19 feet long, 12 feet wide, 11 feet high, and weighed 77 tons, and it maneuvered about on a pair of tank treads. Then after that, Timberjack, which is a subsidiary of John Deere, in 2006, they built a harvester that was a walking hexapod that has seen some use around in the farming world. In 2015, Megabots Inc. completed the Mach 2 Iron Glory, which then famously challenged the Kuratas to a duel. And then 2 years later, they completed the Mark III Eagle Prime. Some of y'all may remember that kind of became like a thing back then where the news was like, oh, there's going to be giant robots fighting. It was not terribly exciting, but the idea that we had gotten to the point where we could have giant robots fighting was kind of just cool in and of itself, even if the reality wasn't really that exciting. And then finally, back in 2017, a Canadian engineering company called Furion Exobionics unveiled Prosthesis, the anti-robot, which is invented by engineer Jonathan Tippett as their flagship prototype. It is a 3,500 kilogram, 200 horsepower, electric power, four-legged, all-terrain walking mech intended for use in competitive sport. It is controlled by the human pilot inside via a full-body exoskeleton interface. In 2020, it was awarded the Guinness World Record as the world's largest tetrapod exoskeleton. And just to get a, if I'm going to take a, yeah, it's more or less like a, it's more of a sort of quadruped exoskeleton than what we would imagine such a large machine would be. But that, again, when it comes to these types of machinery, fantasy and reality often comes in fantasy. But we're slowly but surely getting there. And even though our real world mechs will probably only be of the Shiro Masamune variety, honestly, the fact that we live in a world where such things are possible is just kind of cool in and of itself. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. But yeah, with that out of the way, it is now time to move on to the show proper. And as always, with our show proper, we start off with the assholes of the week. And our first asshole of the week is probably one of the most wildly detested corporations in the world, ExxonMobil, which I need to remind everyone, ExxonMobil has known that global warming was a thing as far back as 1971. And they knew that fossil fuels, especially the fossil fuels that they were regarded, they were for drilling, processing, and selling to the world, was a major cause of it. And they kept denying it and still do. And now ExxonMobil is blaming consumers for global warming and not their decades-long campaign to keep their research hidden from the public. And on top of that, they're also suing investors who want them to be more green and slash climate pollution.
Yeah.
I swear, ExxonMobil is one of the most aggressively reactionary corporations in the world.
Yeah.
Like, just, it's crazy.
Yeah. So they were talking to editors from Fortune magazine that the world has, quote, waited too long to begin investing in a broader suite of technologies to slow planetary heating.
Yeah.
Which is like, gee, I wonder why it took so long. Yeah, then let's see here. Yeah, he made a case for forceful for carbon capture and storage technology that still is kind of in the works that hasn't fully realized itself. As he says here, while renewable energy is essential to help the world achieve net zero, it is not sufficient. Wind and solar alone can't solve emissions in the industrial sectors that are at the heart of a modern society. But yeah, then also, let's see, where's the other quote here? Yeah, just, let's see. He argued the dirty secret is that customers weren't willing to pay for the added cost of cleaner fossil fuels, referring to carbon capture. He said Exxon has tabled proposals with governments to get out there and start down this path using existing technology. Saying people can't afford it, and governments around the world rightly know that their constituents will have real concerns.
Yeah.
So we've got to find a way to get the cost down to grow the utility of the solution and make it more available, more affordable, so that you can begin the clean energy transition. Yeah, saying that he said Exxon could today make sustainable aviation fuel for the airline business, but the airline companies can't afford to pay it. And then blamed activists for trying to exclude the fossil fuel industry from the fight to slow rising temperatures. You know, the sector is the industry that has the most capacity and highest potential for helping with some of the technologies. And it's like, you guys still weren't doing anything either way.
Yeah.
Then see, if your question is what to do about climate change, your answer is one thing. He said, likely a massive build out in solar, wind, and batteries. But for fossil fuel companies asking, what is the role for natural gas in a carbon constrained world? Jeez, this is a long. Okay. Yeah, because he gets to the point here. Yeah, basically saying that people who are generating the emissions need to be aware of it and pay the price on the energy transition, which is like, no, you guys should be heavily investing in green energy means for people, but they're not as much as they should be. And still drilling and producing oil and gas at as high of a rate as they've ever had. So Yeah, there's that bit, and then there's the bit where ExxonMobil is going on the offensive with a lawsuit targeting investors who want the company to slash pollution that's raising global temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
Which generally that's a thing that investors in publicly traded companies can do, is, you know, voice their concern and vote on proposals and such, as well as being able to file mm-hmm. their own proposals to suggest where the company should go. And I guess ExxonMobil is fed up with a pair of investor groups that it claims are abusing the system mm-hmm. by filing similar proposals year after year in an effort to micromanage its business, which is like, that's what shareholders are there mm-hmm. for. Their lawsuit points to growing tensions between companies and activist investors calling for corporations to do more to shrink their climate impact and prepare for a hotter world. Interest groups on both sides of the case say it could unleash a wave of corporate litigation against climate activists. And it is happening at a time when global temperatures continue to rise, and corporate analysts say most companies aren't on track to meet the targets they set to reduce their heat-trapping emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fuel companies are absolutely at the top of that list for ones that should be held to a higher standard here.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they're suing shareholders that are trying to make a change with the way the company is run.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's pretty shitty. Just going against the entire point of having shareholders and being a publicly traded company. So yeah. Fuck ExxonMobil.
Yeah. Just seriously, screw those people. And then we got this awful story. So obviously the food situation in Gaza is obviously not good. And this week there were food aid trucks that were trying to hand out food. And while that happened, the Israelis ended up opening fire on the crowd and ended up killing over 100 Palestinians.
Yeah. Yeah. They were racing to pull food off of an aid convoy in Gaza City on Thursday. More than 100 people were killed in the chaos, bringing the death toll since the start of the Israel-Hamas war to more than 30,000, which was quickly condemned by Arab countries. Joe Biden expressed concern. Let's see. And yeah, while many Palestinians fled the... Let's see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, aid groups are saying that they've, you know, had very hard time delivering supplies because Israel knows that people are going to flock to the vehicles and such that are bringing, you know, medicine and food and water and all that kind of stuff. And
mm-hmm.
that's an easy target for them.
Yep.
And they have acknowledged that their troops opened fire on the Gaza City crowd mm-hmm. Thursday, saying they did so after the crowd approached in a threatening way. The officials insisted on anonymity to give details about what happened. And after the Israel military said in a statement that dozens were killed and injured from pushing, trampling, and being run over by the trucks. And it's like, there's actual video of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see the awful things that happened here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at least 112 people were killed. As Palestine's health ministry described it as a massacre.
Which it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's... I want to say the people that keep track of this have said the food situation in Palestine is the quickest descent that they've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
From having, you know, a decent amount of food to, you know, basically a famine going on there.
Yeah.
So much so that the U.S. is even trying to find some way around this and like airdropping food and such to them.
Mm-hmm.
Which still not a great way to do things. Mm. But yeah, that's kind of, they're trying to work around the way that Israel just kind of makes the situation worse and worse over mm-hmm. there. And yeah, there you go.
Mm.
More bullshit going on.
Mm. Yep. All right. Well, and last but not least, out of my state, Georgia's working on a bill to force all school and public libraries to cut ties with the American Library Association.
Yeah. As a number of right-wingers in charge of, you know, various state legislatures have identified the source of, or a source of, wokeness in libraries as the American Library Association, saying that they have become too radical for, you know, offering grants for libraries to diversify their collection, adding books that deal with BIPOC themes and LGBTQ themes and that kind of stuff. Your Republican State Senator Larry Walker says he sponsored the legislation after discovering his library had received a $20,000 grant to diversify its collection. He says he became determined to stop what he calls the radical organization from being, quote, political indoctrination centers, of promoting aberrant sexual behavior and socialist anti-American rhetoric, which is a whole load of nonsense there.
Yeah.
They're indoctrination centers because people can read and learn things. Especially, you know, books are a great way to learn about people that are not you, have different experiences, all that kind of stuff. He also says here, I feel this is kind of being forced on our children, kind of shoved down our throat. I'm a pretty tolerant individual, but this has gone too far. And it's like, wow, you're offended by books, man. And trying to create legislation about this stuff. There's about 8 other states that are looking at making moves to disassociate from the ALA, including Montana, Missouri, Texas, and South Carolina. Some local libraries have opted out themselves, but Walker's more sweeping bill, the first of its kind in the nation, would force all school and public libraries in Georgia to cut ties with the Library Association. And yeah, I guess this has been... fueled by a social media post by Emily Drabinsky, the group's president. And now deleted social media post expressing excitement that the group would be led by someone like her, quote, a Marxist lesbian who believes that collective power is possible to build and be wielded for a better world. Taylor Hawkins with the conservative Christian lobbying group Frontline Policy Action, which helped draft and promote the Georgia legislation, points to an article by Drabinsky in the academic journal The Library Quarterly a decade ago called Queering the Catalog. She discusses a strategy for queer library politics, directly injecting politics into the library. Hawkins said this is an organization that cannot be trusted with influence over public libraries in the state of Georgia. And I bet you can probably figure out the last time these people have been to libraries. Because this is the kind of stuff they've been doing for decades. They're creating a whole culture war issue that's been brewing around libraries and such, and they're going to do their damnedest to try to make it probably just essentially just kill libraries at a certain point. That seems like what they want to do. Because they got to keep these people from learning from books. So yeah, there you go.
But it's not all terrible, because we do have some heroes of the week to consider. The first one is one that is tragic, yet powerful. A Air Force corpsman by the name of Aaron Bushnell set himself on fire in protest of the government's continued aid to Israel. He did it outside of the, I believe he did it outside of the Israeli embassy.
Yeah, in D.C.
He did it in his uniform, set himself on fire, and then died of his injuries later. I have seen the footage of this happening. It is freaking haunting. What else is there to say?
Yeah, said free Palestine as much as he could until he gave out.
Yeah.
And of course, that kickstarted the conspiracies. And people denying that he could be, you know, in the Air Force or any military branch or anything. And, you know, his family came out and, you know, gave him eulogy and all that in public. And yeah, he is from the Air Force.
Yep.
Cyber defense operations specialist. So very much an active part of the military.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, also right when we were just talking about him being mentally ill, and it's like that's doesn't seem to be the case at all. So yeah, they're trying all their culture war shit to deny this happened, and
yeah,
I don't think it's even the first person that's done this.
Oh God, no! Self-immolation is a very well-known protest tech that goes back centuries.
Well, I mean, in protest of the Israel war.
Yeah, there's definitely been other self-immolators who have done this for in protest of that. So yeah,
I think it was one that happened a few months ago that barely got any coverage.
Yeah,
that people were very mad to find out about after this one happened.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So yeah, and then there's this other one. See, the Democratic primary happened this week in the state of Michigan. Michigan happens to have a very large Arab and Middle Eastern population. And as you can imagine, a lot of those people are very concerned about what's going on in the Middle East, specifically between Israel and Palestine. And so a group of them got together and they said that they would vote uncommitted for the primary, and they actually managed to get uncommitted in second place.
Yeah, Biden still won by a large margin.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm not sure if this is with the final numbers, but as of them writing this, he had over 618,000 votes, and the uncommitted reached over 100,000. So a pretty sizable number there. Trying to basically get Biden and his campaign to reconsider their general stance on the way they're handling things, especially going into the election, because, you know, the people of Middle Eastern descent and all that have a sizable voice, but are still a minority. But, you know, they would very much like to be a part of the voting process versus the way things have been going, trying to dissuade people from voting at all. Because obviously they're not going to vote for Trump, who virulently, you know, hated anybody of Arabic descent.
Yeah. But yes.
And would love to vote against him, but
oh yeah,
Biden has not been doing much to get their support. So they're trying to change that.
Yeah.
Hopefully that works.
Yeah. So yeah, that is our Heroes of the Week, and that was the show proper. It is now time to move on to the proper show proper. And the first story of the night is that we have to say goodbye to the legendary comedian Richard Lewis. He passed away this week at the age of 76. He was one of the legends of stand-up comedy, and he was also known for frequent appearances on talk shows, as a regular appearance on Curb Your Enthusiasm. He was well known for his using his kind of his whole like shtick was that he used sort of like the famously how can I put this? He tended to use like a lot of dark humor, but he used it through the lens of like a typical older, like a, not necessarily older, but like a young Jewish man growing up in the Northeast, trying to deal with being in a large Jewish family. And it worked. He was hilarious, legitimately.
Yeah. He's done a lot of good work.
Oh yeah.
Definitely a big fan of his work and stuff like Robin Hood, Men in Tights is the temporary king.
Yeah, he was King John.
Yeah.
That was one of his best pieces. And and to be fair, that's like one of Mel Brooks's lesser movies, and yet it's still really good. And it's also he is legitimately great in that as King John. The whole thing about the mole constantly moving on his face in every scene, the whole, you know, it was all fun. It was good.
Yeah. Been a big part of Curb Your Enthusiasm as just a longtime friend of Larry. Yeah, he's dealt with a lot of troubles in his life, been an alcoholic and had to be sober for the last, I think it says here, 27 years. He had to deal with that and dealing with depression, anxiety, and all that. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. He had a drug habit as well, cocaine and crystal meth. So, yeah, he's...
Mm-hmm.
Says here he decided to get sober and partly inspired by John Candy's death
mm-hmm.
back in 94. So, yeah. Been a guy who's dealt with a lot, and then it sort of capped it off getting diagnosed with Parkinson's disease last year. So not been a great time for him in the last like 20 years or so. That's why you've generally seen him be in sporadic things over the over that time, as he's dealt with a lot of health issues. But yeah, passed away and left a hell of a legacy in the comedy world. So yeah.
Yeah, it's sad, but... He left a lot of great stuff for us to laugh at, so yeah. R.I.P. Richard. But moving on to something less somber, I guess. The chairperson of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, has announced that she will be stepping down effective March 8th, so that will be Friday.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big figure in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
No idea who would think about trying to take over that. Mm-hmm. What's his face? The pillow man, I think, mm-hmm. has claimed he would try to, and it's like, God, if there's a way to just tank the Republicans completely, make him that.
Mm-hmm.
The head of the RNC.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Good riddance to her.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to see who's going to end up replacing her. I would hope it would be someone somewhat more sensible, but let's be honest, the way the trends have been going, it'll be somebody twice as bad.
Yeah.
And in other GOP resignations, Mitch McConnell will be stepping down as Senate Minority Leader in
November. Yeah. November, I don't think there's a date here. But obviously, he's been dealing with health issues
for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So finally, he's sort of relented on his control of power in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Which means the extremely shitty Republicans are wanting to take over.
Mm-hmm.
Much like they have tried to in the House. And
mm-hmm.
that's going to go real well for them. So, yeah. Kind of wild stuff. Yeah, I think John Cornyn has said he's in throwing his hat in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody else has stepped up. Yeah. So yeah, that's gonna be terrifying to see mm-hmm. who does.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good riddance to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now for something just. You'll see. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments on Trump's presidential immunity case in April.
Yeah. They're throwing him a solid here because they're basically going to start hearing oral arguments the week of April 22nd, like at the end of their current term. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is not great timing, but it's going to allow that case to just get delayed for a good bit, even further than mm-hmm. I think they were hoping to start this month in March. So that's obviously not going to happen here. So that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Another bad thing the Supreme Court's doing here.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's happening. We also got the news that Congress managed to pass a short-term spending bill to prevent a partial government shutdown, because once again, they're going to kick the can down the road.
Yeah, they are working on a longer-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, have just a big, weird meeting with the different leaders, McConnell and... Mike Johnson, Chuck Schumer, and what's his face in the Democrat side in the House, but and the Biden administration kind of working on a bigger long-term funding plan, but they are working their way through that. But for now, the Senate voted 77-13 to approve a short-term spending bill that will prevent a partial government shutdown at the end of the day on Friday. Mm-hmm. The House already passed that bill earlier in the day, so that is signed by Biden, good to go. So that's a whole thing.
So that happened. And now we have this news. So a few years back, Jam Master Jay, the famous DJ for Run DMZ, was killed. And for a long time, people were trying to find out who killed him. Well, this week, two men have been found guilty of his murder.
Yeah. He died back in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And they have convicted, let's see, what are their names? Carl Jordan Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Identified as, Jam Master Jay's godson, has been charged with firing the gun that killed the DJ, according to a report from the New York Times. Federal prosecutors also found Ronald Washington guilty of carrying out the killing with Jordan as a means of revenge after the pair of men learned that they had been cut out of a drug deal.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors argued that the men enlisted a third man, Jay Bryant, who will be tried in a separate trial slated for 2026.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, that's a ways off still. Mm-hmm. This has been a long time thing.
Mm-hmm.
After sort of Run DMC kind of died down a bit.
Yeah.
I guess he started getting into drug trade stuff.
Yeah.
And then that obviously went real bad for him.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that's awful, but the two men will each face a minimum of 20 years. Mm-hmm. The official sentencing set for a later date, so there'll be some justice there.
Yeah, fortunately. And now moving on to some economic news. The Federal Trade Commission and 9 different states are suing to block the Kroger-Albertsons merger, which means there's now a really good chance that this merger might actually fall apart. Which is not going to be good for either, because it means they wasted a crap ton of money on this.
Yeah. And are these two like Southern chains?
Kroger is a Southern chain. I'm pretty sure Albertsons is a Midwest one.
Okay.
Yeah,
I don't think I've heard of them around here, so that might be more to the west of us.
Mm.
Is Kroger the same company that has Fry's, the grocery store chain?
I think they do. That whole they have like a bunch of chains under their umbrella. See, it says here Albertsons is actually from Idaho, so yeah, it's okay. Out west.
Yeah, they're off in the nowhere states. Mm-hmm.
Flyover country.
Yeah. They argue that Kroger's purchase of its biggest grocery store rival would form a colossus that will lead to higher prices, lower quality products and services, and eliminate fierce competition for both shoppers and watchers.
Mm-hmm.
The companies argue that together they could better face stiffening competition from Amazon, Walmart, Costco, and even dollar stores. That Kroger on Monday argued the FTC's rejection of the merger would lead to higher food prices and fewer grocery stores. A hell of a claim there. Fun fact on dollar stores, our mayor here in Canton has said that he wants to stop dollar stores from any more dollar stores from setting up shop here in the city,
because
there's too many of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're all over the fucking place. Even before you start to get to downtown Canton, there's two that are literally across from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fucking ridiculous. And they're not great stores either way.
Mm-hmm.
You can check out the Last Week Tonight show on dollar stores and how they're essentially set up to exploit not only the workers there, but also the poor communities that they're set up in some wild ways.
Oh, yeah.
That if they were, trying to set themselves up as even anything like, your typical grocery store, they would. You would wonder how they exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole thing there. But this seems like an interesting case to get into, because there's definitely a bunch of these kind of larger but more regional chains that merging together would put them on the level of a Walmart.
Yeah.
Something like that. But
and it's like we already have one of those. We don't need more.
Yeah. And Amazon's like they're not a competitor really.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have physical locations. You know, you get into the Costco's and that's a whole thing. Those are weird places like Costco and Sam's Club and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to pay to even shop there, and those are bulk stores.
Mm-hmm.
In a weird way, that's those sort of places seem designed to
mm-hmm.
catch gullible people
mm-hmm.
that end up spending a lot more than they really need to. But mm-hmm. that's a whole other thing. But yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Even for the money there, that's still like a third of what the Activision purchase was for Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how huge that was.
Oh, yeah. And now, this little news. Penicillin is now being rationed in some areas because there has been a huge surge in syphilis cases.
Yeah, fun little medical story here.
Oh, yeah.
Syphilis is back.
Yeah.
In a big time.
I mean, technically, syphilis never went away. It's always been here.
But it's growing.
Yeah.
Nationwide, syphilis rates are at a 70-year high.
Mm-hmm.
The CDC said January 30th that 207,000 cases were reported in 2022,
mm-hmm.
continuing a steep increase over 5 years. Between 2018 and 2022, syphilis rates rose 80%,
mm-hmm.
Which sounds wild. The epidemic of sexually transmitted infections, especially syphilis, is out of control, says the National Coalition of STD Directors.
Yeah.
Surge has been even more pronounced in Tennessee, where infection rates for the first two stages of syphilis grew 86% between 2017 and 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be Tennessee.
Yeah. But this already difficult situation was complicated last spring by a shortage of specific penicillin injection that mm-hmm. is the go-to treatment for syphilis.
Mm.
The ongoing shortage is so severe that public health agencies have recommended that providers mm-hmm. ration the drug, prioritizing pregnant patients, since it is the only syphilis treatment considered safe for them.
Mm-hmm.
Congenital syphilis, which happens when the mom spreads the disease to the fetus, mm-hmm. can cause birth defects, miscarriages, and stillbirths.
Mm.
And so, yeah, across the country, 3,700 cases of congenital syphilis were reported to the CDC in 2022. That's 10 times as high as the number a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
Of those cases, 231 resulted in stillbirth, 51 led to infant death.
Mm.
Number of cases in babies swelled by 183% between 2018 and 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the CDC report is saying a lack of timely testing and adequate treatment during pregnancy contributed to 88% of cases of congenital syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Which seems like just a whole sign of how shitty the healthcare system is. Because
mm-hmm.
people are incentivized to not take care of things as quick as possible because it costs a shitload of money. I'm sure even more when you get into STD stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a whole lot here if you want to read all about it. But yeah, this is a mm-hmm. lot of stuff that's they're trying to deal with the shortage mm-hmm. here. But yeah, it's going to take a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Healthcare stuff is in a shitty place right now.
Yeah.
What was it? I think I saw there's a whole thing on social media, people seeing how measles, mm-hmm. has like a 3% chance, maybe 1-3% chance mm-hmm. of killing the kid. And they're like, oh, let's just stop doing measles vaccines. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's measles is fucking awful for anybody that has it.
Mm-hmm.
Stop fucking treating it like COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, stop treating COVID like COVID, but we need to stop the people that just like, let's just let everybody get these diseases and deal with it. Because most of them don't die. It's like,
mm-hmm.
it's not what the vaccines are for. Better make sure nobody gets it so mm-hmm. it stops being a problem. But yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And now we're moving on into the entertainment portion of the show. The original writer of Roadhouse is now suing Amazon over blocking his ability to reclaim the rights to the film.
Yeah. He claims that Amazon ignored his ability to reclaim the rights for his 1986 screenplay. Mm-hmm. As they mounted a remake starring Jake Gyllenhaal. It's out here in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. His lawsuit alleges that he filed a petition with the U.S. Copyright Office in 2021, requesting that the copyright return to him after the United Artists claim was set to expire in November 2023. The suit goes on to allege that Amazon ignored his claims and proceeded with the film. This is where it gets more interesting, using artificial intelligence to replicate the voices of actors for ADR during the SAG strike in an effort to complete the film before the November 10th deadline.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially scabbing, using AI to scab during the SAG strike so they could get a film out before this deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems to not be the first time that Amazon has been accused of using AI.
Mm-hmm.
For this kind of stuff, when producer Joel Silver was fired from Amazon in November 2023 mm-hmm. over verbal abuse, sources told Variety that the producer was actually being penalized for raising concerns over the streamer's use of AI to complete Roadhouse. And Amazon obviously strongly denied the allegations. So, Hill's suit claims the film was actually not completed until January, months after the copyright deadline has passed. It also raised issues with key literary elements substantially similar to Hill's original script, mm-hmm. including a detailed exhibit demonstrating a side-by-side of original plot points and those of Amazon's retelling.
Mm.
So, some sort of plagiarism stuff here. Because they're probably not paying him to use his screenplay.
Yeah.
As a huge corporation would want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. That's going to be interesting to see how it goes. Mm-hmm. He's trying to seek declaratory relief and aims to block distribution of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it'll take a while and not be a quick decision, but we'll see how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And now, next up, Poor Things will be available on Hulu starting March 7th. This movie has been getting definitely been getting some notice. It's got, who's in it? Let me. It's got Emma Stone in it. It's sort of like a kind of a Frankenstein-esque type story with a lot of nudity. Oh my God, there is a lot of nudity in this movie.
Yeah. This guy's done a lot of interesting work. Yorgos Lanthimos. Trying to see what else he did. Yeah, he did The mm-hmm. Favorite, The Lobster, Dogtooth.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that kind of stuff. So yeah, he does a lot of like dark humors type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's nominated for 11 Oscars, including Best Picture, Lead Actress, and Director.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like it's going to be an interesting movie. I'll mm-hmm. look forward to watching it here.
Oh yeah. We also coming from Hulu, Anatomy of a Fall will be available starting March 22nd.
Yeah, I believe this is in the foreign film category is Japan's mm-hmm. nomination over what a lot of people were hoping Godzilla Minus One would get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I believe that's the one. Maybe it's not.
Maybe. Could be.
It's one of the highest grossing specialized foreign language release post-pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see it. At the Golden Globe Awards, took home prizes for Best Non-English Film and Best Screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure what country. It is in the foreign film category. I thought this might be the Japanese one, but
yeah,
if it's not, it's still supposed to be a very good film.
Oh, yeah.
Courtroom drama exploring the collapse of a marriage.
Yeah.
Stars Sandra Haller as a novelist who is put on trial following the mysterious death of her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Sees her son being called to the witness stand. Okay, this is, missed out on being chosen as France's Oscar entry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's France for that. So, okay. What was the Japanese one I was thinking of? Oh, well, I'll mm-hmm. think about it. I'll do that on my own time. But seems like it's good, another good one that people are hoping to see more Oscar stuff for. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, unfortunately, that stuff doesn't get much of a thing there. But,
yeah.
It did get 5 Oscar nominations, but the foreign film category doesn't make it so.
Yeah.
There you go.
And last but not least, we got an official trailer for Kevin Costner's Horizon, an American Saga, a film in two parts that is a Western that details the story of Western expansion before, during, and after the American Civil War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But technically a four-parter.
I guess, yeah.
I think it's two parts back-to-back and then another two parts back-to-back.
Yeah.
Because this one's out in June, June 28th, and I think the next one's out like early next year.
Mm-hmm.
Or no. The first is June 28th, the second's August 16th. Oh, they're putting out real quick.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, Kevin Costner, who's probably his biggest legacy as an actor is in Westerns.
Yeah. In that, but also he has, I'm actually just kind of happy that he's able to like actually write and direct his own movies again. Cause I don't know if you remember, but he had this notorious, just this notorious reputation for making these enormously over budget movies that just wrecked at the box office.
He had like a big drop off at a certain point.
Yeah, in the 90s, in the mid 90s, after he did Waterworld and The Postman.
Yeah.
Like they both just went. And it basically took him a long ass time to be able to rebuild that reputation, but he did it. He managed to pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's cool. He's got interesting stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
The trailer gives nothing, no context to anything here.
Nope.
Dudes on horses, building on fire, some Native Americans. It's like, I don't know what the fuck's going on here.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is going to be in theaters for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think these are fully funded by him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, going through Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema. So
yeah.
Good on him.
Yeah, he managed to sort of his resurgence basically started like I think around 2012 when he was in that Hatfields and McCoys miniseries on the History Channel, and after that he started doing, you know, Jack Ryan, and he did like a couple of these sort of like straight to video sort of small movies, and then out of nowhere he just started making amazing stuff again.
Yeah.
Also, you know, Yellowstone certainly helped.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's awesome. But yeah, so I do believe with that, we do officially have ourselves a show, folks. We have ourselves a show. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, you got a question, comment, or something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for it in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, archive.org, RSS, or pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator you can possibly think of. So we're going to go ahead, wind it down for tonight. Thank you once again, Chris, for joining me on this. And to all of you out there at home listening or wherever you're listening, if you liked what you heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your family, your casual acquaintances, your coworkers, your mortal enemies, and everyone in between, because they may hate you, but they just might end up liking us. So, yeah, we're going to go ahead and end it here. Join us next week. Hopefully, we will have another show for you. And hopefully it will not have another celebrity death, because it seems like we just, once these happen, we end up having just a string of them for the next few weeks. But I'm not holding out. So, yeah. Wow. It's like having like a celebrity version of like Final Destination Blast Before Your Eyes. But, yeah, so we'll see y'all next week. Good night, everybody.